But hey, enough of my yakking. What do you say? Let's boogie.
Welcome to the Stacking Benjamin Show. Happy Monday and welcome to the happiest place on earth.
What? Damn it, Disney already copyrighted that? All right.
Happy Monday and welcome to the dingiest basement on earth.
Anyone do that? We're good to go, right? All right, rock and roll, baby.
On today's show, we're talking about exchange-traded funds. How's the future look for the hottest investment type on earth? To help us break it down, we welcome the CEO of ASCII Funds, Phil Back. And from the Buzz Index, CEO Jamie Wise. Plus a headline about pensions. Is the end near? We'll throw out the Haven Lifeline to a lucky caller, but still have enough gas left in the tank to answer a letter, serve up a dish of my trivia, and bring you a slice of Joe's mom's peach cobbler. And here they are, two guys who one day decided to cobble together a podcast and they never looked back. Joe and O-J-J-J-J-J.
And what a fateful day that was, huh? How much has this show changed over 5 years? In my head, not at all. But I remember days, remember days when we get together with those first microphones that we had? We'd spend half the day trying to figure out how to make both of us come through the recording. I remember figuring out
how to make the microphone work.
Yeah, I remember one episode where I figured out, this may be episode 7 or 8, where I figured out I was talking through the wrong part of the microphone because I couldn't figure out how to get the volume higher. And then I realized you didn't talk in the top. Remember those old microphones we had? You didn't talk in the top. Yeah, you talked right in there. The side. Yeah. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Monday. I'm Joe Salcihi, Average Joe Money on Twitter, just so you know which voice is which. Across the table from me, he is the other guy, or as we call him here on the show, the original gangsta. OG.
Thank you.
I don't think there's any original gangsta there. I think it's just other
guys. That is correct.
Guy. We're just a couple guys trying to get through the week, and we grab a couple microphones, and we bring you with us. But I got to tell you, we're not trying to entertain you. We're just entertaining ourselves. So,
and we do a fairly decent job of that.
Yes. And anybody that's entertained also, so much the better. You know what's much more entertaining than us, OG? Bam! Is a trip to Magnify Money. Because when you go to magnifymoney.com, what you're going to find is that they are the number one place in shopping those debt products like auto loans, credit cards, mortgages are coming, and more. If you head to stackybenjamins.com/magnify money, I'll tell you what I like. I like the fact that you go there very quickly and they tell you how much baloney's in the fine print. Every company gets a fine print score between A plus and F. So, you know, even before you apply, just how many rings of fire you're going to have to jump through to get that money. A lot of people have debt. Very few people have an actual debt strategy. Do you? If not, it's time to put that together and to help out. Head to stackybenjamins.com/magnify money. And the place that Magnify Money calls number one, if you're looking to save money on those interest rates, head to stackybenjamins.com/SoFi. That's spelled S-O-F-I. They are the leader in marketplace lending. Over 225,000 people have refinanced debt with SoFi. SoFi will help you finance your regular student loans, those parent or plus loans. They funded over $15 billion in loans to date. Listen to this. They've saved members over $1.45 billion, billion with a B, dollars. Our friend Deb Macklin over at SoFi tells us that it only takes a few minutes to find out how you can work with them. So what are you waiting for? stackybenjamins.com/SoFi. They don't only handle student loans, OG, but also personal loans if you're consolidating that credit card debt and mortgages. They're giving you $100 if you use our link for your personal loan or student loan, stackybenjamins.com/SoFi. You can do one of two things with that money. You can use the $100 toward the interest on the loan, or you can send it to your favorite podcaster. And one of the two of those is a good idea. So great show today. We've got a couple guys who are on the edge of the exchange traded fund revolution. You know, what's funny, when I was a financial advisor early in my career, the gig was this. You'd walk out to the lobby and grab the Wall Street Journal about an hour before your client showed up to see what the year-to-date numbers were on your mutual funds that your clients own, like you knew generally where they were and you already had your stuff tracked. You prepped the week before for this meeting, but to get like the up-to-date, where are we today? Well, we'd always had to look at where we yesterday. And what's funny is all those funds were actively managed mutual funds. And look at how much the world's changed just from that. Things are always changing, OG. And I'm excited that we can talk about kind of where the ball's headed with two guys that are on the bleeding edge of where things are right now.
Cutting edge of it. Cool.
Yes. Phil Back, who's unfortunately in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Feel bad for that guy being a Spartan and all. And then number two, Jamie Wise, who I believe is in Toronto. I think he's in Toronto. So he's cool. Aren't all Canadians cool?
Absolutely, they are. Especially the ones that are in Toronto.
We got these cool people coming, but first we have some awesome headlines, so let's move.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's Headlines.
Our first headline comes to us from Investment News. The topic of the day that we'll be talking about more later, Greg Iacucci. Man, Greg can't pronounce Greg's name. Iacucci. Want to take a swing at that one, OG?
No, I'll save my dignity for another.
Yeah, I just buried mine. but Greg has a fantastic piece here that we want to reference. Some active target date fund managers shine as passive management continues 401k onslaught. While passive management continues its steady climb in the target date funds market, a few asset managers with actively managed target date funds managed to outshine their indexing counterparts in 2016. Target date fund assets held by passive managers led by Vanguard Group and mutual funds and collective investment trust funds for the first time surpassed those held by active managers last year, according to Sway Research. However, providers such as Capital Group, which oversees American funds and American Century, did very well. It seems like, even though we're talking about on today's show with our special guests who are waiting upstairs, active funds, there's still a heartbeat. The patient OG, it appears, still has a heartbeat.
I saw a thing on Twitter a couple days ago, maybe. It was a sponsored tweet from American Funds, and it basically said, here's the facts. The facts are...
I saw that too.
Yeah, did you see that? Where it was, it had the nice little bar chart. It goes, here's the S&P, and here's our five flagship funds over the last 40 years. Pick your poison. What do you want? The S&P return, which was, you know, your 100,000 turned into 800, whatever the number was. And they had the chart there to suggest that, hey, active management isn't dead. It's about being smart with your money.
Still, you can't deny that's still.
So here's the thing.
Against the headwind. There's a strong headwind going the other way.
Well, no, it absolutely is. And here's the facts of the case. The facts are people seem to think that you can't outperform the market. That's not true. There are plenty of managers who do. Here's the problem. The problem is picking that person in advance, and there's no way to do that. And that's where you get screwed, because that you're going to throw all this money into active management and you're going to pay five, six, seven times the cost for an active manager or a portfolio of active managers, hoping that one of them outperforms, because statistically some can, right? One out of seven or one out of eight actually can outperform the market. The problem isn't that there's not those people. The problem is selecting those people the day before they do it. And so enter passive ETFs and you go, well, since I can't accurately predict that or no one can, I'll just go with the flow.
Well, and then you have groups that do kind of what you guys do, which is, hey, we're going to index, but that doesn't mean that we're going to give up the ghost. I know part of what you guys do, OG, in your practice is you'll take indexes and you'll skew them in a way where the probability is that you're going to outperform just because you're betting on things that have happened so often.
Yeah, we use much more of a what we call an asset class approach as opposed to just a flat index approach. So we still use low cost investments and that sort of thing and control the costs where we can there. But we don't completely give up the ghost on the human element of trying to make good decisions.
I'm not just throwing it in the S&P and saying, okay, I'm gonna be mediocre every year.
Yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, there's just not anything wrong.
I think that we can try to do a skosh better. And if we can do that for a low cost, so be it.
You know, there are also active fund managers who nearly on a yearly basis beat the pants off the S&P 500. The problem that you also have there is that you can't afford them. They do not make themselves available to you. Like if you're that unicorn that can actually do that, and the unicorns do exist, as I just mentioned, they're going to charge a heck of a lot of money.
Yeah, Ray Dalio, he exists in real life. You just can't get an appointment with him.
That dude's a whack job, by the way.
Also, he's crazy.
He is certified. Have you read all the things about how they run office?
Yeah, he's actually resigning as CEO.
He needs to, because just scary things. I mean, don't get me wrong, brilliant asset manager, but the way he runs a team of people, I would not want to work for that dude.
Yeah. You know, here's the other thing that's coming on ETFs, and I saw this in an article, and it was the first time I had seen it, but it got the wheels turning. I bet that we're going to start seeing, if it's not already prevalent yet, advisors who use ETFs in an active manner. Oh. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Well, I think we'll also talk about, we have the things like...
we've got all sorts of different ways.
Yeah, we have that thing like Eaton Vance, you know, who's a big active fund manager last year. I don't even know what happened with this product.
That's right. It was like an active ETF.
Yeah, an active ETF. Maybe we'll ask Phil and Jamie about this.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, good stuff there. But it's not dead for active funds. I think you got to be smart about how you apply that logic. Number two on our list of awesome headlines, this comes to us from Zero Hedge. And I don't want to go too much into this piece because there's a lot of speculation here, but I thought it was an interesting headline for us, OG. Our collapsing pensions, quote, about to bring hell to America. Like most things on Zero Hedge, this is written by Tyler Durden. It says the toxic dollar is bringing hell in a handbasket, along with the student loan debt bubble and other major financial factors. The looming pensions crisis is bound to be the death of us all. Because it's based on a future promise to pay, it has long been a benefit dangled to solve strikes and union disputes, because in the end, it's just more debt, whether private or public. They go into some of these public plans that are pretty scary. South Carolina's government pension plan, $24.1 billion in the red. Of course, the CalPERS plan. And you look at what South Carolina's doing, if you track what pension fund managers do, they're chasing more alternative investments in stocks now to try to bump up that rate. And people, you know, part of the pension's contributory and the contributions on pensions have gone from a much lower number, somewhere in the 6% range, to north of 8% of your pay has to go into the pension in an effort to try to save it. This pension bubble, we've been so, you and I have talked so many times about the student loan bubble. The pension bubble started to burst back, you know, during the housing crisis. This is still
during the recession.
This is still out there, man.
It's always interesting to me when we hear the stories about it. The community that I live in is having a really big problem with this right now, and it's not getting any better anytime soon. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, unfortunately, because they allow people while you're working to take your pension lump sum out and invest it in an IRA. So if you thought that your pension was going to go under and you could take your money out today, what would you do?
You're taking it out.
And then they're saying, well, but we need the money in there to like pay the benefits.
To make it better. Going,
that's awesome, but not my money. You can use somebody else's money to pay somebody else's benefits. I'm cool. Duh. And since these government benefits were so top heavy, I guess, so beneficial, I don't know. What do you say about that? These people are getting like gigantic checks.
It's a self-fulfilling
prophecy.
Yeah.
The thing that's interesting to me about it is how poorly the decision-making is, or was, probably still is, on the investment management front with all these things.
Yeah, I don't want to get into that too much. I want to focus on the other half of this, which is if you've got a pension, or if you're evaluating two jobs and one of them has a pension attached to it, I don't know that, you know, 5 years ago, I would have said to you, yeah, that kind of plays into it. Maybe you want to look at the company as a pension. I think it almost has no benefit anymore. I'm like, yeah, pension. I'm going to be here for at least 20 something years, hopefully. Forget it. Well, and the chance that I'm going to be there 20 years is low. So between the chance that I probably won't have this job very long, and number two, the pension fund managers are playing darts on my money, I don't know that I want anything to do with that.
Well, and so for your financial plan, what do you do with that? I think that if you're late stage retiree, right, or you're about to retire, I think you can use your pension as a reasonable number.
I think you're okay, right?
If you're younger, I think you got to start building some plans of lopping those pensions in half or 75% off, and say, can I still make my plan? If all of a sudden they stop sending me all the money, they send me half the check instead.
I think that's definitely lesson number one. Got a pension?
Make some alternate plans.
Amen, brother. And then number two. actively managed funds, not dead, but either A, you can't afford it, or B, can you pick the year they're going to actually outperform? I don't think so. Two fantastic guests waiting in the wings, OG, Phil Back and Jamie Wise. The big question on all of our minds is, where are active funds heading? We talked about it, of course, during the headlines. When I was a new advisor, my job was to pick a manager who was going to take care of my client, right? By the end of the time that I bowed out of financial planning, the path was already heading toward where it is today. Lower fees and closer results to the index. So where's the future headed? Is it all indexes? Well, today's guests, I think, are part of that future. The American Customer Satisfaction Core Alpha ETF trades under ticker symbol ACSI, invest in America's most well-liked companies. It's a simple premise. Companies that have the highest customer satisfaction are bound to have the best sales and thus the best stock returns. Ann Arbor-based ACSI Funds has conducted research to prove that much. And Phil Back, not only did that, OG, he used to be the guy that helped the New York Stock Exchange roll out exchange-traded funds. So Phil might know a little bit about what he's talking about when it comes to exchange-traded funds.
Might listen to him. Okay, cool.
Of course, our second guest on our roundtable today, he is a former hedge fund guy. He also runs a fund that you've heard about a lot on this show if you've listened to our podcast for any length of time. Jamie Wise is the CEO of the Buzz Index, trading under ticker symbol BUZ. Their proprietary algorithm tracks the buzz around social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and blogs to find the wisdom in the crowds and tracks and buy stock in those companies. Two very interesting strategies. Two strategies also, OG, that you would say are active strategies, right? But not active in the way that active used to be. So where's the ETF ball headed? Phil Back and Jamie Wise coming down to the basement. And I'm so excited about this segment. I've been waiting all week to interview these guys. Coming down to the basement right now, first of all, he speaks often about ETFs and how they're created. He formerly was the head of ETF listings at the New York Stock Exchange, but today we're interested in his fund, the American Customer Satisfaction Core Alpha ETF, ticker symbol ACSI. He's Ann Arbor-based. Welcome, Phil, back to the basement. How are you, man?
Good. Thanks, Joe. How are you?
Well, I'm good until I said that you're from Ann Arbor, and then I think I might have to disown you a little bit.
Well, luckily, we've got a lot of Michigan State representation on our team as well.
That is good. You told me that earlier, and tell you, you've got, what, three or four Michigan State people?
That's right. And one of whom who is a professor right now in the grad school. So he's somebody on our research team. We've got a former soccer star from Michigan State. So we also have a guy from Grand Valley. So we're across the state of Michigan. We are Switzerland.
You got, that's right. You got it all covered. You redeemed yourself there, Phil. So thank goodness. And also joining us from Buzz Index is the guy we talk to once a month, trading under the ticker symbol BUZ. We're happy to have him back. Mr. Jamie Wise joins us. Welcome back, man.
Great to be back, Joe. Happy to be here. And I understand Phil may be Switzerland, but of course we're Canadian. So we're all going to get along just fine.
That's right. Because Canadians, you people just get along with everybody, don't you?
That is our mantra. Yeah. I think it's written there on the flag somewhere. It's a
kindler, gentler country, right? Well, let's jump into this, guys, because you have two very different funds with different approaches, but you're both breaking down some of the traditional barriers with ETFs. And I want to start, Phil, with you. Let's talk a little bit about your ETF. When did you realize that there was a correlation between stock prices and customer satisfaction, and that was something that should be packaged as an exchange-traded fund?
Well, the way this thing started actually was I had to run a few errands. I had to pick up a whole bunch of stuff from my kids' camp one year, and there was a Kmart very close to my house and a Target a little further away. And I wanted to go to Target. I didn't have a lot of time. The Kmart was close, so I thought, you know, how bad could it be? And I went to Kmart with a list I had to buy bug spray and bathing suits and backpacks. And I'm standing there and the store is filthy and there's no one at the cash register. There's no prices on items. And it was just a miserable experience. And I was waiting in line endlessly for the, you know, at the only cash register that was actually open, thinking to myself, how do I bet on Target against Kmart? Because essentially they're the same store, but a very different customer experience. Then I started thinking about, well, how do I bet on JetBlue instead of Spirit Air or Shake Shack instead of McDonald's? And I started looking for the data. It turned out that the world's expert and the world's authority on quantifying customer satisfaction was not far at all from where I live, right in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I went down there, and of course, it turned out that they were managing successfully two hedge funds based on this data for many years with exceptional returns. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to create an investable index with the data that we thought was more of a retail-based product that could generally more or less match the risk levels of a broad cap-weighted S&P 500 index and deliver it in an ETF to investors.
We're going to turn this into a roundtable discussion in a minute, but I want to follow up just on that for a second, Phil. How do you measure customer satisfaction in the index?
Customer satisfaction that's the whole trick here is how do you quantify customer satisfaction, right? I might have had a bad experience at Kmart, but there might be other people that, you know, for them, the fact that it's not so clean, but it's low cost is a trade-off they're willing to take. I mean, certainly I brought up Spirit Air. There are people who love Spirit Air because to spend an extra $100 on a flight just to get a bag of peanuts doesn't make sense to them. So we have a proprietary econometric model, which is fully patented. We survey over 100,000 customers, and I say customers and not consumers because we care very much about what the actual customers that transact with the business have to say about their experiences with that business. And we're trying to weed out the outside opinions so we can get a better sense of what customer retention will look like for companies going forward. So we partnered with the American Customer Satisfaction Index, who I referenced before is the world's authority on quantifying customer satisfaction. And we use their data in our index to manage our funds.
Got it. And then do you rebalance it or have new names in there monthly or quarterly, or how often does it change?
Yeah, we rebalance on a quarterly basis. We have constraints based on sector level and the individual security allocation level. So, you know, we're trying to generally match a traditional large cap fund. We rebalance on a quarterly basis, not a tremendous amount of turnover in the names because in order to be included in the index, we have to have a large enough sample of customers to be able to measure. That limits us to about 160 stocks that we can use, but the weighting of those stocks within the portfolio is based entirely on what their current level of customer satisfaction is.
Gotcha. Jamie, let's turn to you for a second and dig into the Buzz Index for just a moment. When did you figure out that following the wisdom of crowds was a good idea?
Well, Joe, it started about 4 years ago for us when we saw some of that academic research, early academic research that was talking about mining online content for, you know, broad-based discussions around stocks. And could you take some insight from that conversation with respect to sentiment and the prospects for those stocks from an investment point of view? It was certainly interesting to us and a little bit early days. But a couple of years ago, the conversation online really exploded, and we got excited when we could see that we could measure a consistent level of conversation across all broad-based U.S. equities, larger cap U.S. equities, and then start to identify changing shifts in sentiment around those stocks and really get behind the ones that had the most positive momentum behind them.
What channels are your primary channels that you guys focus on at Buzz?
Yeah, you know, the biggest volume of data certainly comes from Twitter. And, okay. And Twitter, most people use Twitter as a launching point to longer form content. So if you're a financial journalist or a blogger or just someone in, you know, who keeps a daily tally on what they're doing in the markets, oftentimes you'll present that to the world through Twitter and then link it back to your own specific site. So Twitter is a big one for us. But then there's a whole host of really financial focused websites where investors and traders gather to talk about stocks all day long. We look at newspapers or online financial posts where people are commenting on stories from journalists and media outlets. Anywhere where people are talking about stocks, we're listening.
And does the criteria of the person matter? So if I've got, you know, Joshua Brown from Reform Broker versus Billy Bob, who just changed out my muffler down at the muffler shop, does that matter?
You're laughing because you think Billy Bob's opinion doesn't count. And we're here to tell you that enough Billy Bob's opinions count if you can aggregate them. So much in the way that Phil was talking about their approach, which is going out and polling 100,000 customers, you know, we're trying to listen to millions of people that are talking about stocks online. And it doesn't matter how sophisticated you are, and I'm going to put sophistication in quotes here, as an investor, or whether you're an analyst on CNBC with a big microphone in front of you, if you're in independently offering your perspective on a stock's prospects, what you're doing personally in your investment portfolio, where you're putting your dollars to work. If you can measure enough people, you have enough breadth to that conversation, enough diversity within that conversation, the overall average collective view is really powerful information to know.
Well, thank you both of you guys for digging in a little bit about what you do, just so people can see kind of where ETFs are headed. Because as you know, it's not just SPY, the diamond, the Qs, like people buying these very basic things anymore. I mean, the things that you guys are doing are, I think, are incredibly innovative and a lot different than what people have seen from exchange traded funds in the past. Phil, do you pay attention to the size of the company that's in your ETF?
No, we don't. Well, we generally try to match, you know, the parameters, the average market cap of a large cap fund. But, you know, for us, it's really about having a sample size of customers that we can get a good read on and that we, you know, that we have comfort in being able to, you know, look at the view and the direction of the company. When you talk about the size of the underlying company, typically you're referencing the market capitalization. Market capitalization is an entirely backwards looking indicator, right? Because you're looking at what the value of the shares and the shares outstanding are, and the value of the shares is entirely driven off the historical earnings and the future earnings projections, but all based on data that's out there in the balance sheet. And it's not, there's nothing forward-looking about that. There's nothing that's a leading indicator about that. So what we're trying to do and what Jamie's trying to do is really find different ways of looking at the market, different ways of looking at the world, where we think we can get out in front of those numbers and use the data as a leading indicator.
Well, and that's my next question, Phil, for you is then, do you think that the Morningstar style box, right? The large cap value, large cap growth, large cap blend, mid cap value growth blend, yada, yada, yada. Do you think that that's dead? Is that dying? Are we seeing now that we can kind of throw that away as an average investor out there in America?
No, definitely not. Traditional asset allocation, modern portfolio theory are great. I mean, they've done a lot of good for a lot of people. It's mathematics. It works. The thing is, though, right now, the secret's out, right? A balanced portfolio of low-cost Vanguard index funds is now the baseline, whereas, you know, just 10 years ago, that might have, you know, given you an advantage for your clients or for yourself versus someone else who's buying expensive, actively managed traditional mutual funds. Now, we're seeing that low-cost index funds and traditional asset allocation, that's the baseline that you're competing against. I can go online and I can Google a portfolio of, you know, 60-40 low-cost funds and have it at my fingertips in a matter of seconds. So if you want to do better than the baseline, if you want to do better for your clients or for yourself, you have to have an informational advantage. You have to have some systematic process that you can incorporate into modern portfolio theory to try to have an edge and, you know, hopefully one that's an evergreen strategy that should work, you know, as well 20 years from now as it'll work today, that should work in all market environments. And nothing's always going to work, but at least that the expectation is that you'll be able to do better than that baseline because you have this informational advantage that you're using.
Yeah, Jamie, do you think the Morningstar style box is dead?
Dead is a strong word, but I am very comfortable saying it's dated. What we're living in right now is a world that is awash with data. There is so much information out there, and taking that, you know, traditional approach of whether it's just historical performance or balance sheet analysis to try and make investment decisions or rate your portfolio is really the old style way of thinking. It's just not relevant anymore. We are inundated with amounts of data. We are all on social platforms. We are all sharing our experiences with brands, with products, our investment criteria. And if you're not able to take advantage of some of that data, whether you're a portfolio manager for one of those mutual funds and you're trying to analyze Target versus Kmart, sure, you can go into a store yourself. You can have a meeting with the CEO, but you can also now amass massive amounts of data to validate and complement that decision and really give you the insight you need to make the complete picture whole.
So you agree here that you agree with Phil that data's your leg up.
It has to be. Absolutely. If you're not already thinking about how you're benefiting from a massive amount of data that's out there that can help you in your investment decisions, you're still living in that old structure. And those things that may have worked in the past when data was limited to everyone can't work anymore going forward because the sophisticated investors are certainly making use of that data.
I know that you guys can't tell individual investors, you know, what to do with their portfolio and obviously you don't know the people listening to the show, so I understand that you can't give individual advice, but I'm wondering where you see your portfolios. Do you see your portfolio as a 5 to 10% holding as a piece of it? So to Phil's point, you're using asset allocation to do as well as everybody else, but then you're tweaking it by using your strategies or another strategy that gives you maybe a leg up? Or is this now the new hull of the ship where you're comfortable telling people that, you know, maybe 40% of your portfolio belongs with us? Jamie?
Yeah, I don't think it's our place to, indicate to your listeners how much of their portfolio should be in any one security. The question they have to make for themselves is, do we want equity exposure in our portfolios? And if the answer is yes, and we want domestic equity exposure, which a lot of people have, it's what's the best way to capture that? I think the great thing about the growth of ETFs and smart beta ETFs is you can really think in a rules-based approach, how you want to structure holding equities in your portfolio. Do you want to own them based on market cap? Do you want to own them based off of some other insights, whether it's growth, value, dividend, sentiment, customer satisfaction? Whatever factor you believe in will have the best predictive nature in determining forward returns, you can really access now through the ETF landscape in a simple, convenient, rules-based approach. And that's something new that all investors should be taking care of, taking advantage of.
Yeah, Phil, do you agree with that? If somebody at a dinner party tells you that 60% of their portfolio is in ACSI, are you telling them that's fantastic or that they might want to back that down?
No, I mean, very similar to Jamie, where, you know, I couldn't tell somebody whether for their personal situation it's appropriate or not that they should be in large cap equity. But to the extent that they're investing in large cap U.S. equity, we feel comfortable that our ETF, that the ACSI ETF, is appropriate for 100% of that exposure. It's not a satellite position. We believe that valuing companies based off the likelihood of repeat customers and the likelihood of, you know, otherwise customers leaving or, you know, a company being able to amass customers is significantly more valid than any of the traditional metrics, including smart beta. Now, if you combine it with other factors, it is an optimizing factor. So if you want to combine other smart beta approaches or even market capitalization weighted with customer satisfaction weighted, you will see some optimization in your portfolio. But we feel very comfortable as long as somebody, you know, has the risk tolerance and the interest in investing in large cap U.S. equity, with them allocating 100% of their position to the ETF if it was appropriate for their personal situation.
Gotcha. And you know, it's funny, Jamie and you talked about smart beta, Phil. Jamie talked about rules-based investing. We've seen for a long time the statistics on actively managed mutual funds, right? And how supposedly during down markets or during times certain times they might be able to tweak some returns out. And yet the way a lot of mutual fund managers are paid, it seems like they're unable to beat the index. They end up, you know, barely trailing the index because of the fact that they don't get flogged if they just lose by a little bit instead of try to win. Do you see, Phil, your rules-based approach or smart beta type of approach, do you see that kind of replacing the actively managed funds, or will there still be room in a portfolio for actively managed approaches?
I think the definition of actively managed is going to shift over time. I think both of these funds are really what active management is going to look like in the future, where there's a rules-based approach and there's a process by which you expect more often than not always, not in every short-term market cycle, but over a longer period of time, you know, the longer the sample, the more certain the outcome, that you're going to expect some outperformance. But by using a rules-based approach, you eliminate the possibility of somebody, a portfolio manager, being a cowboy or taking unnecessary risk, right? And you eliminate a lot of those risks that were traditionally associated with, you know, active management of old. These types of funds, I mean, this is what hedge funds have been looking like for many years. What's really new and different here is that we've taken the ACSI data, and Jamie's taken the big data, and we've packaged it in the efficient vehicle of an ETF. So now investors can not only access these strategies, they can do it in a very efficient, low-cost vehicle. And it's, you know, a democratization, if you will, of the strategies that have been traditionally, you know, thought of as more hedge fund type strategies only for accredited investors.
And I think what you're saying, Phil, then, I know very clearly because I know what the rules are around this ETF. I know exactly what game I'm getting into, where with a manager, I might not know about his stomach flu and the fact that he picked the wrong thing on that day.
Yeah, that's right. And the subjectivity that, you know, the active managers used to have Is that something that's a positive or a negative? I think in the past it was considered a positive. You know, you'd look at the fund manager, you know, you would trust them with their decisions, but the performance of actively managed funds over, you know, the last 30 years or more has really shown that that subjectivity is not a good thing. It's not something you want. You want to eliminate it as much as possible. Yeah. By using a rules-based approach, you can have a very good sense of exactly what your risk parameters are, what your expectations are, you know, based on historical data over different market cycles and over different time periods and time horizons. And you can have a much more honest assessment of what your return expectations should be relative to the benchmark.
I completely agree with Phil here. What we're talking about is style drift, right? And if you have a portfolio manager for a mutual fund, he's one human being and he is susceptible to all the same flaws that we all are as individuals, in that we can overreact, underreact, change our opinion to fit the facts or change our opinion to fit the scenario that's playing out in the current market. When you add all those things up together, that can lead, and typically does, as we've seen over 30 years, like Phil just said, underperformance. And you don't want that. You don't want to expose yourself to that risk within your portfolio. And that's where rules-based approaches really can make a lot of sense, because you can really be, you know, laser in and target in on what exactly you're trying to accomplish in your portfolio. So why rely on one person's judgment, which can be flawed or susceptible to those risks on a day-by-day basis, when you can benefit from so much greater insight from either thousands of people's views or, you know, their perceptions on customer satisfaction, whatever the case may be.
You know, we saw last fall Eaton Vance roll out, I think it was this last fall, God, geez, it might have been 18 months ago now, rolling out the fact that they were working on an actively managed ETF, that they were going to try to put management and ETF in the same spot. Based on what you said, Phil, I think that you're insinuating that approaches like that might be dead on arrival.
Yeah, I mean, I think that solves the problem for Eaton Vance, right? Because Eaton Vance wants to offer their same strategies in an ETF and, you know, take advantage of all the structural advantages of an ETF relative to a mutual fund. But they didn't want to give away their secret sauce. They didn't want to be transparent about what they were doing. And they wanted to hold on to some of that proprietary nature of their strategies. Well, that might solve a problem for Eaton Vance, but that doesn't solve a problem for any investor. I've never heard an investor say, gee, you know what? I want to give up transparency in my portfolio. I trust the portfolio manager so much that I don't want him to tell me what he's doing, because then he doesn't have to tell the market what he's doing. That's a trade-off that I've never heard an investor myself, I've never heard an investor ask for. So, you know, maybe Eaton Vance does have clients for whom it's appropriate, and there's certainly nothing wrong with the idea of, you know, using the benefits of an ETF in an investment that would otherwise be non-transparent anyway in a different structure. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But the question is, who are they solving a problem for? And I don't see that market as much as I see a market for people who are looking for different, new and different ways to access the capital markets in a way that really do better than the baseline of low-cost cap-weighted funds.
Yeah, this is some investment advice that I'm comfortable giving your listeners. Beware of the transparency argument that there's some magical secret sauce that a portfolio manager has and they don't want to show you the portfolio for fear of giving up that recipe. All of that is a red herring to protect fees. And for the most part, people see through it. There should be no problem showing investors what is in your portfolio. We're all invested in very liquid large cap US equities. Those things are not going to be moved by us showing investors what's in the portfolio. Beware that transparency argument.
It's so funny, Jamie, the what, 5 or 6 months that we've talked on Stacky Benjamins. I think you're reading my mind, because you just answered the question I was going to ask you. So I think that's a phenomenal place to leave it. Great last word. And I think we'll start with you, Jamie, here at the end. Tell us how people can learn more about the Buzz Index.
Sure. Head on over to buzzindexes.com. There's lots of content there. We podcast, of course. We have blogs, white papers, research reports, and really an AI industry watch list there. That's a great resource for people just to stay abreast of what's happening with advancements in these technologies and how they're being applied to finance. So certainly you can learn more about the index and the BUZ listed ETF, but you can also just stay current on all the things that are happening around this industry as people transition to a more 21st century approach to investing.
Phil, thanks a ton for joining us. How do people find out more about ACSI funds?
Thank you, Joe. ACSIfunds.com, ACSIETF.com. And if you really want to dig in on some of the data that we have on customer satisfaction, take a look at ACSIMatters.com. And again, the fund ticker is ACSI. Thank you, Joe.
Awesome. And you know what, everybody? I'll have links to all those if you're out walking the dog or driving to or from work on our show notes at stackybenjamins.com. Jamie, Phil, thanks a ton for playing. I appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks again.
Hey, trivia fans, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and you know, my pappy always used to tell me, hey, get your head out of your Then he'd say, everything I ever wanted, I had to work hard for. Well, that's why when I realized I was working for Benjamins, I'd do the really hard work when they arrived, which is why I'm doing this show. I can't waste my energy on these fools who offer me 10, 15, or 50 bucks an hour. No way, Jose. I'm holding out for the big money. And as Joe's mom says when I'm asking her for seconds on the beef stew, good things come to those who wait. So that's why it's your lucky day, because I'm here with you delivering trivia. Here's today's awesome question. When the Dow Jones Industrial Average was created way back in 1896, a couple of years before Joe was born, there were 12 original companies. Of the 12 original, which one is left?
OG and I are excited to have two sponsors at Stacking Benjamins that we can send people to who will help any of our listeners get their financial house in order. First of all, let's solve your debt problems by sending you to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi. That's S-O-F-I. We talked to Dan Macklin about SoFi because they started in student loans, but then quickly moved on from there. We wondered exactly why they started with student loans.
Student loans just seem to be a bigger issue for people. There's over $1 trillion of student loan debt out there. And it really is and continues to be a pretty inefficient market. Lots of people overpaying. But we've quickly moved on from that. So as well as student loans, we're now doing other things, including mortgages and personal loans. But student loans was just a great entry point because so many people were overpaying.
So if you're someone who's overpaying for student loans or for other types of debt, whether it be mortgage or personal loans, head to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi. And once you've been there, we'll send you to stackingbenjamins.com/MagnifyMoney. Because the thing about Magnify Money that I find really cool is that they do not ask for any personal information before showing you how different financial products rank against each other. And part of that rating system is just how little fine print there is. So we asked Nick Clement, CEO at Magnify Money, to explain more about their rating system and helping you avoid fine print.
Oh, the fine print can get out of control. You'll always see marketing which tells you this is free or we're even going to put money in your pocket if you do business with us. But then when you look underneath the hood, you can find fees on top of fees on top of fees. And some of the worst are in the world of overdrafts, where you can be charged $35 per item. And then after 5 days of a negative balance charge, another $35, particularly in that area, you see banks that are worse than payday lenders, although they're not advertised that way.
So for checking accounts, savings accounts, and debt products that you understand, head to stackingbenjamins.com/MagnifyMoney.
Hey, trivia fans, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. Can one of you help me out with something? The smells coming from the kitchen are amazing. Could one of you run upstairs and grab me a slice of that pot roast? Thank goodness Joe's mom feeds me whenever I stop by, but these dorks don't give me time to eat. Let's give you that trivia answer before Joe and OG lay claim. Before the break, I asked you this question. Of the 12 original companies in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which one is left? I'll give you 3 seconds to answer. 3, 2, General Electric? Who knew it was that old? Pot roast, here I come. See ya.
Big thanks again to Phil Back and Jamie Wise for coming down to the basement. What a spirited discussion. Oh, gee, the active funds definitely, definitely changing how they do business.
Yeah. And they're not going away, but they're...
it's going to be... There's no doubt
there's gonna
in my
head.
There's
going to be some consolidation.
Well, there's also no doubt in my head that it's going to be algorithmic like these guys are. We're going to actively move things, but it's not going to be some dude in his gut deciding, you know, or some woman in her gut deciding which way they're going to guess tomorrow. It's going to be driven by data.
Do you think that the active managers don't do that now? Is that what you think?
I think they do it, but I think that a lot of the active managers out there, they get all this data and then it goes through a person on whether we buy or not.
You're saying the computer is going to take out that buy sell decision.
Yeah, guys like Jamie and Phil just get out of the way and say, nope, computer decided, take me out of the equation. Yeah, interesting. You know what they spend their time on? Like they said, they spend their time on tweaking the data set, right? Making sure that the computer's actually spitting out the right stuff, which is another interesting conversation because then you still got the human.
It's the human that's programming the computer. So,
yeah. Well, big thanks. By the way, if you want more about the American Customer Satisfaction Core Alpha ETF or about the Buzz Index, just head to our show notes, stackingbenjamins.com. American Customer Satisfaction Core Alpha is ASCI, and the Buzz Index is ticker symbol BUZ. I have to disclose this. I own shares of BUZ, so I think I got to tell people that. Doesn't mean that it's great for you. Just means that I own a little piece of that. All right.
Look at you. You're pulling like a Jim Cramer here.
Well, you have to, don't you?
Saul Ceesay's charitable trust invests in BUZ. Is that what he does?
Definitely not my charitable trust. Unless
have it in your charitable trust.
Unless you believe the charity starts at home. Then yes, it's in my charitable trust.
Then it's in your charitable trust.
Yeah. Hey, let's throw out the Haven Lifeline and tackle some of life's, or rather life insurance's, most important questions. Our friends at the Haven Life Insurance Agency have been spearheading innovation within the life insurance industry by focusing on those two things you value most, your family and your time. It's why they created a high quality and most importantly, affordable term life insurance policy that you can purchase entirely online. No need to wait several weeks for a decision when you can get one instantly with Haven Life. Head to stackybenjamins.com/Haven Life now for a free quote and to learn more about life insurance the modern way. You know, the thing we never talk about when we talk about the Haven Lifeline OG, I love their tool that tells you how much life insurance you need. If you go to stackybenjamins.com/Haven Life, you know why I like it? Because different than most that give you a number, the Haven Life tool does what you and I do, which is it comes up with a range, right? You need to be kind of between here and here, Mr. Ms. Client. Where do you think you should be inside that range? And then you have a great conversation. And like Jerome Benzie said when he was on the show, the CEO over at Haven Life, you know, life insurance still, there's a lot of data, but piece of it comes down to emotion. Correct. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, I don't have much to add there. Yes, it does.
Ta-da! Yeah, maybe after 5 years, I'll learn to throw things to you in a better way. All right.
Maybe not.
Yeah, today's question comes to us from our new friend, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hey, Joe and OG. I'm 23. I've been fully funding my employer match 401k 1-to-1 to 3%, maxing out my Roth IRA, saving 10% in actual cash in my bunker, money in Robinhoods, in ETFs such as Buzz. I have 1 year in a safety fund. I basically have no recurring expenses except for rent and utilities. Is there something else I can do in the meantime? I plan on moving into a school bus in 2 to 3 years, so I want decent returns in the meantime, but I will need the money in a couple of years. What are your thoughts? I love the show, and thanks for teaching me nothing.
Thanks for the question, Aaron. Going to move from his bunker to a school bus. Those are big. We don't have dreams that big.
Is that a joke?
I'm sure. I mean, maybe not. I took it as a joke that he's in his bunker now and he's moving to a school bus because, I mean, that's what Doug wants to do. So, yeah. But for Doug, it's not a joke. But I think for Aaron, it was. But that's fantastic. Okay. A great question. So he's very young. He's doing all the right things. He's even has some play money out there, right? When he said Robinhood, which is a zero cost stock trading platform app. So he's doing the core portfolio. He kind of has the satellite fund things he's doing. He's got his emergency fund. What do you think?
Well, if the money you need in the next 2 years, it's got to be in something very liquid and safe, right? It all boils down to whether or not you'll be upset if the money is half of its value when you go to need it. If it's a goal that's hard and fast, where you say, you know, in 2 years, I need to pay $10,000 for my kid's tuition, right? Like there's no wiggle room in that. You can't tell your child, well, sorry, no college this year. Come back when the market's higher. Then that money needs to be safe and secure. If you look at it and say, yeah, I'd like to get it out in 2 years, but if it takes 5 or 6, so be it. Then you can invest it a little differently. This comes up all the time, right? Like, why do I have to put my money in cash isn't there something else I can do for the next 2 years to make some more money? No, not really. I mean, you can find a 2-year treasury bond, I suppose.
You just
but that's
look
not going to be much better than cash anyway.
No, right. You make an extra $4. You know, you look at the results of the stock market over a 1-year time frame and what type of betting.
The range of returns, right?
Yeah, the range of returns. What type of betting you're actually doing. We call the standard deviation, and it's ugly. It is just absolutely ugly. So instead of going to the stock market, why don't you head down to a casino and just put it on red, because you'll at least have fun watching that little ball go around instead of, you know, watching it disappear in the stock market over a 1-year period of time. But over 10 years, that deviation goes way down. So that's the thing that I didn't hear. I think Aaron's doing all the right stuff. It's so cool to hear somebody that young who's doing so many cool things. The only issue I have is there's a difference between doing what you can and doing what you should. And whenever I go to companies and I'd ask people, so how much are you putting in your 401k as an example? And they'd say X percent. And I would say, well, how'd you come up with that number? They'd say, well, it's what I can afford to do. And then I would ask, where's that going to put you when you get to your goal? And the answer almost every time was, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't base it on that. I like doing what Stephen Covey says, which is beginning with the end in mind, right? And I realize he's so young and it's so far away. I'll tell you who he reminds me of. I had a client who was a young, aggressive client. His goal wasn't necessarily financial independence at an early age. He just hated saving so much. This is great. He hated saving so much. He wanted to save boatloads of money now so that when he got to like 45, he could totally pull back and he could save nothing or very little. And he could just take massive, awesome trips the rest of his life. And well, you know, that was never my goal. For him, it was so funny. He's like, no, I hate it. So I want to do a lot of the pain now. Let's get the pain out of the way. Let's save as much. And he and I put together a plan of how much money he would need to save at 45, even though this is the key. His plan was to not touch any of that money till 65, right? But he could shut off his saving at 45, use the money he was saving to go play when he wasn't working, but he still wanted to work.
This sounds exactly like my plan, only backwards.
Yeah, you're going to do all the playing now, save a bunch of money later.
I hate saving so much, I'm going to do it all on the back end.
That's right, do it all later. I don't, that compounding interest, that's for losers. Nerds. Yeah, doing all that stuff. But I think tying his money to goals, I think, is the big thing that I'm not
hearing. Well, it really is, yeah. Congratulations on getting off on the right track. And why only save 3% in your 401k? Max that thing out, dude.
Yeah, check that baby up. Then he can get a double.
Then you won't have any extra money to monkey around with, because you'll be saving another $15,000 a year in your 401k. You'll feel pretty broke, so that's the goal.
But in retirement, he could live in a double-decker bus.
Yeah, there you go.
That's the way it is. Thanks for calling, Aaron. If you've got a call for the Haven Lifeline, which is the quick way. Aaron, by the way, sent that note about 20 minutes before we recorded this.
Perfect.
Yeah, just in time. Steckybenjamins.com/voicemail, or head to the question for the show page. You'll see the Haven Lifeline right up on top. Below that, you can write out a question for the show. We're still running about a month and a half behind on your letters. Speaking of letters, we do get letters. Doug brought down the mail today. And, oh, gee, we got a fun one here. This one comes to us from Thomas. Thomas says, hey, Joe and OG, I'm consolidating accounts and planning to transfer the contents of a cash account into a mutual fund account. Both accounts are tax sheltered. In order to keep this status, I have to close the cash account and transfer the whole balance in one go. The result of this operation is a 3x investment in mutual funds. By default, it'll be stored in a cash park at 0% interest. What would you advise on how to incorporate this lump sum? Invest everything in one go according to my allocation plan. Sounds like timing the market to me. Or forfeit interest for 3, 6, 12 months and drip feed the money in to make the most of dollar cost averaging. Putting everything in money market funds and then drip feed. I'm living in the UK, but I don't think this fact matters. Keep up the good work, Thomas. And Thomas is right. Dollar cost averaging versus lump summing in doesn't matter where you're at. And hello to Thomas in the UK. Thanks for writing.
I will be in the UK in a couple of weeks.
Party on with Thomas.
Yes. So any restaurant ideas, I'm more than happy to.
As long as they're in the London area.
Well, anywhere. I mean.
Yeah, but you're not headed to Manchester anytime soon.
Who knows? I don't know.
If the party gets wild.
I don't even know how far away that is. So When I looked on the map, I was like, I can go to Scotland. And I looked how far it was to drive. It's like 10 hours. I'm like, and I'm not.
It's probably nothing. Yeah. So what do you think? This is the age old question. OG.
This is an easy one for me. Invested by nightfall. Yep. I mean, you got to use odds in your favor, right? So statistically, the stock market goes up 70% of the time. So why do you want to wait a year on some of that money to get it invested? Now, it could turn out to be the right choice, right? The stock market could be at an all-time high today, right now. It could be starting to go down as we speak and bottom out in 12 months from now. And you'll be happy that you still have 1/12 of your money still sitting in cash that you've bought as the share price has gone down. That's more of a gamble than putting it all in one day. So this is a very easy thing. You've got your allocation. Take the money, invest it in your allocation before nightfall, and move on with life.
I'm going to give you a choice in my answer to this question, just a little bit different. I think first, Thomas needs to look at his plan and see if he absolutely needs that 70%. You know what I mean? That he's got to bet by putting it all in right now. Because if he needs to bet, he wants to bet with the odds. And so if he's behind on his goal, put it in right now because the odds are way heavier in your favor. But then I asked that emotional question that we asked last week to another listener on the show that had the inheritance. And that was, which one to make you feel worse? You dollar cost average in and the market just goes up like it usually does and you miss out on a ton of return, or you lump sum it in and the market goes down right after. It's that time that it's the 30%. And once again, as I said during that episode, people always would tell me, oh, that's obvious. And it isn't obvious. It's obvious to you, but people answered that question different ways. So if you can afford to wait, I would still do it OG's way with the 70%, but I'm not you. So I would ask myself those two questions and see which way that came out.
Love it.
Yeah. Good question. If you've got a question for the show, send those to me, joe@stackybenjamins.com. Once again, that is the slow boat to the Stacky Benjamin Show. The faster way is to use the Haven Lifeline, stackybenjamins.com/voicemail. And if you're somebody that's looking for good financial help in your corner, OG's taking clients. How do you become OG's client? Well, first you pinch yourself because this is even available. Is that too much hyperbole?
No, that's good. That's right. Yeah.
Is that too over the top?
Yeah, it's about the right amount.
And then just before you go skipping down the sidewalk, you head to stackybenjamins.com/letter O, letter G, stackybenjamins.com/OG. And that'll lead you specifically to a calendar where you'll have a call with OG to talk about exactly how that process all works. And on that note, I think we did it, man.
Another one, huh?
Monday's over. What a fun time. I just love hanging out here doing this stuff. And if somebody else is entertained, so be it. Fantastic for them. But really, I think it's all about you and I just talking money. Whoever thought that we could just grab a couple microphones and talk money for an hour a couple times a week? Pretty damn cool.
It's great business if you can get it, I guess.
I don't know. I remember how amazed I was, you know, when we read that 65 people were listening and I was in shock. I'm thinking of like two.
I remember when it was six.
Two classrooms and full of people.
Yeah. I remember when it was six and five of those was like me hitting refresh on iTunes.
Right.
Like there's somebody that listened to
this.
There
actually is one. Yeah. There is one. That's so awesome.
There's somebody. It's
Mom
great.
And her bridge club. It's cool. Yeah. All right, everybody.
Very humbling for sure.
Fantastic week. We'll see you back here on Monday. Go stack on Monday. Jeez, it is Monday. We'll see you back here on Wednesday. Go stack some Benjamins.
So what did we learn today? Probably nothing, but let's give this a shot anyways. First, roll to the end credits because I think it's safe to say the world of active trading is officially changing. Convinced passive only is the right approach? If Phil Back and Jamie Wise have anything to say about it, you'll be reevaluating that statement. Second, pensions? If you have one, great. But if you're young and have one, maybe you shouldn't count on it heavily when completing your financial plan. But the big lesson? Don't get stuck doing the end credits when Joe's mom rolls out the apple cobbler. Those two knuckleheads are already upstairs chowing down, and I'm stuck here talking to you. Special thanks to Phil Back for stopping by. You'll find our link to the American Customer Satisfaction Core ETF on our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. We're also glad that Jamie Wise could stop by again. Of course, you'll find more about the Buzz Index at stackingbenjamins.com/buzz. This show is the property of SB Podcasts, LLC. The show is created by Joe Saul-Sehy, produced by Richie Rutter-Reese, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remuneration. There's no way you would take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only, and before making any financial moves, consult with a real financial advisor. Hey, and check this out. While I was talking to you, Joe's mom just tiptoed over with my very own apple cobbler, which feels suspiciously like someone is about to ask me to clean out the gutters. See ya!
I have a story I was telling some friends, but I think I have to wait because this movie's going to get old. It's going to get too far away from the theaters, and I really want to talk about it. We went with friends, maybe now about a week and a half ago, to see a little film with a little monkey in it. little ape. This is called Kong Skull Island.
These are photos of an island in the South Pacific.
The place where myth and science meet.
We use explosives to shake the earth, helping us to map the surface of the island.
You're dropping bombs.
Scientific instruments.
Is that a monkey?
You knew that thing was out here?
I'm sorry for your man, Colonel. But if you want to make their sacrifice worthwhile, get us home with proof. Monsters exist.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Your friend there can put that down.
What the hell is this place?
That's calm.
That's Kong. He's the king of this year island, says John C. Reilly. Lots of big names in this movie. Tom Hiddleston, Brie Larson, Samuel L. Jackson, John Goodman, of course. I just mentioned John C. Reilly in the film. This movie was not one that I wanted to go see. I had friends that wanted to go see it. Cheryl's like, oh, I think it'll be fun. Let's go see it. And not really anything else playing at the theater. So it was more of a, you know, go out to dinner and a film with friends to have a good time. And initially, it starts off really campy. Of course, John Goodman's character thinks that he has discovered this island that is a place where nobody's yet explored, even though, you know, we've explored every other place on Earth. So he's trying to convince a congressman to help put a bill through that will allow them to get government money to do it. He ends up able to do it, and he recruits people who are just finishing their tour in Vietnam. This movie is back from in the 1970s. Samuel Jackson is the head of that group and says, hey, we got this volunteer mission and people want to stay a little bit longer over here in the South Pacific, and if they want to help guide us along the way. What a romp, man. As much as I despise the movie Logan, which I thought was going to be this fun action movie, this movie, it was so by the book, exactly what you expected. They took all of the formulaic pieces of the movie that you wanted to see, that you thought you'd see, and they did them so absolutely well that I was on the edge of my seat the whole time. I thought it was fun as all get out. The bad guys were bad. The good guys were good. The plot was went exactly point by point, which should be marks against it, right? She'd be like, oh, crap, I've seen this movie 100 times. No, I've seen this movie 100 times, and they nailed it.
And you still like it.
Oh, I didn't like it. I loved it. I thought it was so I thought it was so fun. Kong Skull Island was a movie that just surprised the heck out of me. I can't believe I'm saying, man, that was great. Because I went into it going, oh, are you kidding me? You know, I'm watching all these movies that are up for Academy Awards, and I'm hoping for those type of movies. And then I got to see this. And I go into that and I come out going, fantastic. Absolutely great. This cool. movie, OG specifically, you'd like this movie.
Even with the big giant monkey?
Even with the big giant monkey. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. When Kong appears at first, they do a great job of the CGI.
Hold on. It's not real?
Sure.
Spoiler alert. I mean, at least.
I should have said that ahead of time, shouldn't I?
At least say that. Jeez.
Yeah, sorry.
We got to edit this thing now.
Sorry about that. Got to go back and edit, right?
So the whole thing is based on a fake monkey?
Isn't that baloney?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they don't put anything before it. I think it's fake. They don't put anything before it that says based on true events.
Oh.
But maybe, you know, that's part of the conspiracy theory there. Maybe it really is, but they don't want anybody to know.
All right.
Bad news for me. You know how I always complain?
Like Jurassic Park was real.
Yeah, exactly. You know how I always complain about people not staying to the end of Marvel movies and mm-hmm. watching that trailer? I walked out at the end of this, found out later there's a scene after the credits, and I missed it. Yeah, so I got to go on
for YouTube.
I got to go online and watch that, right? All right, everybody. That's Kong Skull Island. We'll see you on Wednesday.